Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of the JMO Podcast. I'm your host, Taylor Michaels, and our guest this episode, we've got Tom Wynn, NWT Pro, back on the show. Tom's one of our all-time favorites. He always shares great fishing information. He's got great stories to tell, especially great story that we talk about in this interview. Recently, Tom won the NWT Championship over on Green Bay on Lake Michigan, and that's 2 years in a row he won the NWT Championship. Last year, he won it on Lake Huron. Many of you would remember that podcast. Tom was gracious enough to share his time last year after winning the championship, and then again this year. So super, super appreciate having Tom on anytime we get the chance to chat. We're going to get right into it here. We've got the NWT Championship. There's some really, really great elements to this story. I think that a lot of people are going to get a lot out of this. There's just a lot of great fishing takeaways here. So let's get to it. Tom Wynn, NWT champ, two times. The waterfowl hunting opportunities here in the state of North Dakota are incredible. It's a tradition for so many friends and families to get together and spend this quality time in the field. But to be a great hunter also means to be a great steward of the land. I'm talking about being very respectful to landowners. And don't leave trash in the field. Definitely don't clean your birds and then throw carcasses back in the field. If you do encounter gates, make sure you leave them exactly how you found them, whether that is up or down. Hunting is such a wonderful component to North Dakota's legacy, and we need to keep it that way. So let's all agree this fall to hunt hard, hunt fair, and hunt for tomorrow. Devil's Lake is one of North Dakota's premier outdoor recreational destinations. And to find out more about what the lake and the community of Devil's Lake has to offer, head to devilslakend.com and get all that. We're talking about the lodging and restaurant options and just the lay of the land and everything going on in the community. There's all kinds of stuff all summer long going on in and around the community of Devil's Lake. That link is in the description. Summit Fishing Equipment brings technology and innovation together to improve fishing equipment design and usability. Their forward-facing sonar shuttle transducer pole combos are designed to be used year-round. With just a few accessories you'll find on the website, you can mount the shuttle and transducer pole right in your boat, making the transition from ice season to open water incredibly simple and cost-effective. Check out everything they've got at summitfishingequipment.com. Use code SUMMIT10 at checkout for 10% off all orders online. That link is in the description of this podcast. The Onyx Fish App is the roadmap to your next great fishing adventure. The Onyx Fish App brings together all the great research tools that we talk about all the time on the JMO podcast with all the top pros. I'm talking about satellite imagery, lake surveys, fisheries data, contour maps, the list goes on. They're all in one place now. Anglers in the Midwest have never had a more valuable research tool at their disposal. Head over to the website to subscribe today. Use promo code JMO for a discount at checkout. And I'll say it again, your next great fishing adventure that you don't even know exists can be found on the Onyx Fish app. Back-to-back years, dude. Pretty incredible. Let's just start there and get the whole story out of the way. I'll probably pick a few stops throughout this story here to maybe kind of press on a little bit, but I just want to get it out there so we can talk about it, man. What is the story of this year's NWT championship win?
This whole year NWT is another good season. Pretty solid. I didn't have such a good finish on lacrosse this year. I went into the season the most excited, actually, about lacrosse because of what I learned on pool three and pool four last year in those beads in the backwater. But this year, what I didn't account for was, the low water season. And so those backwaters just weren't there. I didn't have a very good finish. So that's what hurt me in the angler of the year points. But I can't complain. I think I finished like sixth or seventh this year in Angler of the Year. But as far as going into the championship, just to be in the top 40 with all of the top touring pros in the country and against all of these locals who jump into these tournaments, to come out on top again, just to come out on top anytime is unbelievable. But much less, 2 years in a row at the championship, It didn't even register when the tournament director, Jeff, said, announced that I won with my weight. Like, I was just in the moment for that one tournament. But, you know, going in there 6 days prior to the championship, just looking at the extended forecast, because when you're on the Great Lakes, that's what you're doing all the time, just checking that wind forecast. And the forecast for that weekend was, it held true. It was the exact forecast we've been looking at all week. So we should have all been prepared for a potential blow day, or maybe two. It was looking like there for a while, 2 days could have got canceled, but thankfully just one did. And so with that wind, it was a really strong wind from the west, and I am learning a lot about the Great Lakes the last couple of years, traveling with, you know, Tommy Kimos, Chase Parsons, Corey Springle, and, you know, this time it was me and Corey fishing the championship, traveling together. And there's no better person on the planet to help understand and teach the system of Green Bay than Corey. And thankfully, he was right there with me. And, you know, he struggled in that tournament. But, you know, when he puts this all together, when he puts together what he knows, combined with just committing to those electronics up front, he's going to be hard to beat. And that's coming. But yeah. Anyway, he convinced me. He's like, Tom, look, I wanted to run up to Big Bay. I wanted to make that big run up there because last year I, in the tournament at Green Bay, I made that run. I didn't catch a limit, but the fish I caught were giant. I caught a 12-pound 32-incher last year in the tournament. I caught a 9-pounder in the tournament. It was just crazy. Awesome. And so I wanted to make that run, but Corey is like, well, you can. They might be up there, but with this blow we're having, there's a good chance that that's going to ice out up there. And not just that, but the wind is going to create for a really rough ride. Yeah. So, and that was a long run. So he talked me out of that. We focused on the islands area from Chambers, southeast to Hat, up north there to Sister Islands. We just focused there and really didn't focus at all on the west shore because we knew with the wind coming, it also was going to ice out, which it did. And so in pre-fish, it was like calm conditions, like abnormally calm conditions. So we could cover water. Me and my buddy Sean Grams were pre-fishing together again. And we would go around, and there was a couple days we only caught one fish. There was a couple days we caught six. One day we caught eight. And I think one day we didn't even catch anything. But it was nerve-wracking. Like, you know, didn't get a limit. And you know, I shouldn't say didn't get a limit, but I didn't get a limit every single day of practice. And this tournament is actually the first time I've ever gotten a limit in a Green Bay tournament.
Really?
Yep. A full tournament limit. this is the first one. And people ask me, you know, at the tournament meeting or in interviews, they're like, hey, are you out there cracking them? Are you catching them? This and that. And I had to remember, like, wait a minute, I don't think I've ever cracked fish here on Green Bay, you know? So, but I told people, if I do catch a limit, it's going to be a good limit. You know, and thankfully, that's what happened.
So, you know, I'm sure a lot of people that pay attention to the NWT, they're kind of familiar that, you know, the championship, it's a 3-day championship, 40 boats fish the first 2 days, the top 10 after that fish the third day. This year, day two, it got blowed out. And then on day three, just the top 10 from day one went out. Okay. That being said, walk me through day one. Like, what was the strategy going in, you know, in terms of like how did the strategy sort of play out in the execution? Did everything go to plan? And just kind of walk me through day one, I guess.
Yeah. So I guess it didn't go to plan, because I was shooting for 34, 35 pounds.
So, oh, nice.
It worked out better. My plan was, because I knew there was a really good chance that day two was going to be canceled.
Yep.
And my plan was, was to keep the right away in the day, only keep 8-pounders, but then if I needed to, start keeping some 7s, you know, and that's very, that's really aggressive.
Oh,
like
yeah.
That is something that's hard to do mentally, but thankfully I didn't have to make those decisions too much because I get out there to my first spot, literally my first main area. I get out there, put the trolling motor down, and I instantly just start seeing some fish. Now, it wasn't like it was loaded. You know, a lot of people just probably assume that places I'm fishing, like the screen is just lit up with big fish. It's not the case. But there was just enough. There was enough that what I saw in practice in this area, it was comparable. So I was like, all right, this is good. The wind was not fun. I mean, we had big waves there. I have a 75-inch Garmin Kraken trolling motor, and every now and then there was waves coming through that would bring that sucker out of the water. So we still had some big waves, big winds, but presenting that bait to those fish was key. And I've always said it, walleyes, in most cases that I've seen, want a really slow fall and a really slow presentation. And so in that water, I was fishing between 28 and 45 feet of water, and I was using a 3/8 ounce jig in that wind. But that, you know, to account for those fish swimming, the wind, the bow in the line, boat control, it sometimes took a couple casts to get that bait so the fish could see it. And but going into there, I never moved. So once I put the trolling motor down, the trolling motor stayed in the water until I was heading back to weigh in. I never left that spot. And we came in early, over an hour and a half early to weigh in on day one with that 43 pounds. And I was just shocked, actually, that that's the weight I brought in, because in practice, I saw some couple of nine pounders in practice, but you know, I attribute it though to in practice, I'm not grinding a spot. I'll go check it, I'll catch a good one, and I leave. Right. So during the tournament, my head was down grinding, and my co-angler was very instrumental. Gary Slagle, he was very instrumental in our championship win. He was in the back on my live scope at the console. He was shooting out 130 feet off to the side, just on one side. I had him shooting out, and he was able to, you know, like say, Tom, there's a fish out there at 110. There's a fish out there at 80. And here's the thing that I've never experienced before is the fact that every fish that he saw or every fish that I saw was big. I didn't have to worry about determining size. So that was awesome for day one.
Was that by design? Like, was that something that you had picked up on in that area during pre-fish?
Yes. So when we went there in pre-fish, there was a couple times we caught like two maybe off that spot. And there was times where we caught one. There's times we didn't catch any, but that was my best area. For some reason, it only held big fish, or not held big fish, only big fish passed through there. I think it was a travel route. And
that's interesting.
So yeah, it was just pretty, you know, we just had a really good day.
Yeah, dude. I'm curious, like when you're pre-fishing and you're sizing up your spots, I think you are right. At least for me, you know, you talk about how, you know, maybe like a non-tournament angler, somebody with less experience does probably assume that when Tom Wynn cracks them, it's because you found the mother load and they were snapping. There's so much more to it than that. And in a lot of cases, you're not even looking, like it's intentional. It's in a lot of cases, it's intentional that you're not looking for the mother load. I'm curious, did you have that decision to make? You know, like you had spots that had a lot of fish on them, but maybe, you know, it was a lot of 5 and 6 pounders mixed in with the 8 pounders when you were going through your spots. Was there another plan B that was tempting you? Was there anything in hindsight that was like maybe a difficult decision at the time. But of course, in hindsight, we know that you did it right. But I'm just sort of curious about that, if we can go back in time a little bit.
Yeah, so in pre-fish, almost every spot that Sean and I would check was, we saw a big fish. There were some spots and areas where we would see some little, not little ones, but 4 or 5 pounders mixed in. But for the most part, every spot that him and I checked and scanned with forward facing sonar, we would end up seeing a big fish. Now, I learned something though in that practice. There's a lot of rock on Green Bay, and a lot of the walleyes, most of the walleyes relate to that rock, whether it's shallow rock, deep rock, it didn't matter. But what else related to that rock are gobies.
Mm.
I couldn't imagine like diving down there with a camera, and I just imagine those rocks to be literally crawling with gobies. I'm serious. I just have it in my head that there has to be swarms of them, because if you're throwing a reaction bait, you're with every few casts, you're going to be snagging one of them things with a crawler or plastic. Those things are just piranhas down there. And so to keep, and when you experience that, you would hardly ever catch a walleye, right? Even though you're casting at a walleye, those things would just come up and come over and just be a nuisance. So what I noticed was these two, I only had two spots. Three. I had three spots in this tournament, two main spots, and then one spot that was a really high risk area. So the first two spots was on the same stretch that a lot of people who watched my live stream saw me stop at. It's probably like a mile. The two spots are maybe less than a mile apart from each other. But those two spots were on the edge of where rock started turning into mud. So there was still some rock. I'd say like 15, 20% rock, maybe 10% rock, and mostly mud. But no gobies. That was key. That was extremely, extremely key. And so I only had those, that main area with my two spots. And day one, I only had to check one. Day two, on day one, I had like a boat. There was a couple of tournament boats on my other spot that I could see when I looked, you know, when I was fishing my main area.
Sure.
But then my other area, I would call it my, you know, third spot, which I never fished in the tournament, is a place where there's a lot of current. Like probably one of the highest current areas on Green Bay. And every time I went through there, it was a long pass. It was a really long, risky pass. But every time I would make that pass in practice, I caught a giant. One. Every time. But that's risky because that's a really long pass that I had to make to find one big fish. So I knew that that was a backup if I absolutely needed one or two big fish to fill out my bag. But my main spots had fish cycling through them constantly. You call it the mother load. A mother load to me is something where I can catch 5 big fish in an 8-hour period.
Yeah.
So I'm not talking like stacked with big giants, you know, that's, and because I used the word mother load, which I don't think I've actually ever used that, to a buddy of mine during pre-fish. He called to check in and I'm like, dude, I just think I found the mother load. Meaning like there's potential here to catch 5 big ones. Even though I didn't do it in practice, I could see them. So for me, it's like, and I've said it to you too, like, if I can see these fish, why do I need to catch them right now?
Yeah.
I need, you know, so in number one, you could potentially give your spot away if you're fishing them. Number two, I mean, Green Bay is huge. So many walleyes. But, you know, I could sore lip a 30-incher that could potentially be in a couple of days during the tournament.
Yeah.
So, that's how that went. I never went to spot number three. On day two with that big blow, I was concerned that the water temp was going to plummet over there, but at the same time, I was confident that it would hold steady. I went over there on day two, or day three, the final day, and hit that first spot, made one pass, and I saw zero signs of life. Not at all. Not even a minnow. Water temp had gone down 7 to 8 degrees, and that told me right there, like, dude, you're screwed. Like, in my head, I was mentally preparing myself already to zero. Like, I literally was. I'm, like, talking to myself saying, dude, you're going to zero on this day. They're gone, and that's all you have. So then that's when I decided. I'm, like, I got on my big motor, started heading east, the direction the wind had been pushing the last few days, and I noticed within seconds, after about 2 miles, my temperature went from 58 degrees to about 63. Immediately, I'm like, huh. So I stopped, put my trolling motor down in a place I hadn't pre-fished, and instantly I started seeing life, minnows, some bait balls, some suckers on the bottom. Finally saw a couple of smaller walleyes, and then searching, and finally started seeing the right marks. And I'm like, okay, this is where I've got to be. It's been a few hours. I caught a fish, and I caught a 4-pounder right away on camera for the NWT camera guy, and he probably records me holding it for like 1 minute because I almost put that 4-pounder in the live well because I was stressing out.
I got a couple things I want to pick apart, and some of them can kind of wait till like the ending, but you were articulating why you like to use a lighter jig. You like a more controlled, maybe a slower fall, a slower presentation, you know, and then you're talking about pre-fished where as long as you see them, you don't, why do you need to catch them?
Yep.
Well, the obvious question that I have for everybody, you know, at this point in time of an interview with a tournament angler is, you know, the obvious question that I need to know more about is like, well, you got to catch them to know what they'll eat or know what they're eating. And, yep. And I know that it wasn't just a lights out bite that every fish was just chomping. I watched enough of the videos, you know, guys had really great pre-fishes. They were catching them, but as tournament day and the weather and whatever it was that went into it, not everybody caught them really, really great. So I'm curious to have you sort of, you know, your version of this particular story of this particular tournament on Green Bay, how did you sort of, or how do you decide where your confidence to catch them is going to come from? It's obviously not a lights out bite. Like how do you, yeah. Like what's your story on knowing whether or not you're going to be able to catch them on tournament day?
Well, it just comes back. It just, your confidence baits, you know, it comes back to your, not just that particular tournament, but when I went to Green Bay, I had two or three things tied on that were my confidence baits from the season, from last season. This year, I'm experimenting with some reactionary style baits, for example. Not to bring up a different tournament, but the Dakota Walleye Classic on Lake Sakakawea. We repeated that this year, and that was on a reactionary style bait. I threw no live bait. Can you believe that, everybody? I did not throw live bait. So,
it's hard to believe because, man, I was there. It's not easy to get those nice fish to bite at the DWC in July on Lake Sakakawea. It's not easy. So, yes, that is a pretty big statement to make for people that maybe aren't in the know.
But I'm, you know, trying to grow as an angler myself, trying to develop confidence with other styles, other tactics, learn fish reaction. So I had reactionary style baits tied on. I had my black tungsten jig and crawler tied on. I had the smeltnator jig tied on. And I was just, you know, if you have confidence and you're fishing it correctly, you put a blue jig or chartreuse jig in my hand, I'll probably fish it and maybe a tenth of a second faster. Just because I want to get it in and throw my black one. You know what I mean? Like, you need to throw your confidence. And just because fish stop biting for a little bit Like you're catching, you might catch a couple right away in the morning on your confidence bait, but then you go 3 or 4 hours, which happens to me a lot. Go 3 or 4 hours or the rest of the day without catching them. It doesn't mean that they those fish change their mind and want something brighter, right?
Yeah.
Like they just shut off for the time. They something happened. The pressure changed. The barometer something changed. And these fish shut off a little bit. The water temp dipped a little bit. Who knows? But to me, it's just keeping that confidence in your hand. And when people start spinning out and just trying to interpret why these fish quit biting is when they start struggling and wasting a ton of time, switching colors, switching styles of bait, switching this, switching that. And it comes back to bite people big time. I mean, we can see the fish now. I mean, it's not like we need a color so the fish can key in on it. We need something confident, and my confidence baits are all natural colors, black being the most natural in my mind. And that just keeps me, you know, super confident and knowing that that's going to be, you know, like what I'm going to catch them on. Like I'm not, you know, going to be switching here and there and all these different colors and stuff like that, which I see too much.
The Onyx Fish App is the roadmap to your next great fishing adventure. The Onyx Fish App brings together all the great research tools that we talk about all the time on the JMO podcast with all the top pros. I'm talking about satellite imagery, lake surveys, fisheries data, contour maps, the list goes on. They're all in one place now. Anglers in the Midwest have never had a more valuable research tool at their disposal. Head over to the website to subscribe today. Use promo code JMO for a discount at checkout. And I'll say it again, your next great fishing adventure that you don't even know exists can be found on the Onyx Fish app. The waterfowl hunting opportunities here in the state of North Dakota are incredible. It's a tradition for so many friends and families to get together and spend this quality time in the field. But to be a great hunter also means to be a great steward of the land. I'm talking about being very respectful to landowners. And don't leave trash in the field. Definitely don't clean your birds and then throw carcasses back in the field. If you do encounter gates, make sure you leave them exactly how you found them, whether that is up or down. Hunting is such a wonderful component to North Dakota's legacy, and we need to keep it that way. So let's all agree this fall to hunt hard, hunt fair, and hunt for tomorrow. Devil's Lake is one of North Dakota's premier outdoor recreational destinations, and to find out more about what the lake and the community of Devil's Lake has to offer, head to devilslakend.com and get all that. We're talking about the lodging and restaurant options and just the lay of the land and everything going on in the community. There's all kinds of stuff all summer long going on in and around the community of Devil's Lake. That link is in the description. Summit Fishing Equipment brings technology and innovation together to improve fishing equipment design and usability. Their forward-facing sonar shuttle transducer pole combos are designed to be used year-round. With just a few accessories you'll find on the website, you can mount the shuttle and transducer pole right in your boat, making the transition from ice season to open water incredibly simple and cost-effective. Check out everything they've got at summitfishingequipment.com. Use code SUMMIT10 at checkout for 10% off all orders online. That link is in the description of this podcast. And the other thing that you mentioned, we're kind of going to walk, you know, we're walking through championship day here right off the bat, the big massive adjustment that you had to make, and you're putting all the pieces together with the water temperature and you're finding the life, you're finding the fish. But you said something else that was kind of interesting. I'm sort of curious about your mentals, where you had your inner voice, you kind of had an internal conversation and you made peace with the fact that you were going to zero that day, or maybe that's the wrong way to say it. You maybe didn't make peace with it, but you convinced yourself that zeroing was a possibility. Walk me through your mental strategy in that moment. You're in first place. You're leading the NWT championship. I'm sure you've thought about it all night, or, you know, social media or anybody that you're talking to probably kept reminding you. So it's you're obviously hyper aware of the circumstances and that everybody else is watching, or can't wait to to see, but you're a couple hours in, your A spot from 2 days ago is totally burned to the ground. And you know, you're on the hunt, you know, talk to me about the mentals in that moment.
Yeah, I guess that's what it was. Like I was, you know, just me kind of coping through that situation. Just go, you know, I had another, 5 hours to convince myself that, hey, you're zeroed, but things are going to be okay. You're still going to move forward.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I'm like, you know, still, I thought these fish have to have gone somewhere. And, you know, you hear the stories. You hear the story of these anglers just adjusting, figuring all this out. And me, I was having that mental battle first when I put the trolling motor down the first time, made that pass through. I need to go back and watch my live to see actually how long it took me to go through that first pass. It wasn't that long. That's how big that spot was, man. It wasn't very big. So I went through that first pass pretty quickly, and I didn't see a single sign of life, not one. And so whenever that happened, I'm sitting there thinking, I need to go back through it. Maybe I missed something.
Mm-hmm.
That was my head. I'm like, how is there no fish there? But I did see the water temp was way lower. But still, my mind said, Tom, go back through that spot again. But then I started fighting myself. I'm like, dude, you know better than that.
Yeah.
You teach people on the Great Lakes that when the water temp lowers like that, you need to go. I'm in the midst of recording right now. Not recording. I'm in the midst of putting together a body of water specific course through THU on one of the Great Lakes.
Nice.
And I'm sitting there teaching people, right? I'm teaching people. I just recorded the deal where I say, hey, so I had to take my own advice.
Yeah.
I had to be like, do not go back through that section. You caught 43 pounds there 2 days ago. So that's pulling me to go back and check it one more time. But then my brain is saying, dude, you just looked. Your electronics don't lie. You know what you're looking at. You're good at this. Move on. So then I went to the second spot. Same thing. It was easier for me to move away from that second spot because I moved away from the first one. Then that's when I'm like, dude, you're gonna zero. And then I'm like, okay, think about this. The wind, you've heard the guys on day one talk about how their spots on the west shore iced out, and the wind has been blowing from the west very hard. So it's pushing that cold water across the lake. So then I'm like, just start going, start going east. And so like that, and here's the thing, going east was in the direction of high risk spot number three. Right.
Okay.
So actually that's where I was heading. I was heading to high risk spot number three, big winds, ripping current. The way that the islands and stuff set up, there was a little narrow section where current just ripping. Even on calm days, it's going, but this day would have been high risk. So I was actually on my way there, which was, you know, probably 5-6 miles away. I get 2 miles into the run, pay attention to my water temp. And I was like, hey, the water temp's here. It just raised up to 63. Let's just check it. Let's look. And I went out to the same depths that I was comfortable with, where those gobies probably won't be so prolific. And that's where I ended up doing all that damage. And within probably an hour and a half, maybe, I had three fish. I had in the box, I had a 6 and 3/4 and an 8. And then the camera guy got out of the boat, went on like a 40-minute hour lull. And then then I really figured it out. I'm like, uh-oh. I kept two small fish in there, and those small fish were those 6-pounders, but I figured it out. I figured out where these fish were, why they were there. And within a short time, I had the other three to fill out our live well. And the last fish I caught was a 29-inch 8-pounder. Can't throw that sucker back. So we were in by 12:45 to the dock. That's how quick it happened. Like, and not too many people know I came in that early, but I came in at 12:45 after my people following me on that live. My live cut out, and people were getting worried that I didn't catch a fish. But what I found, though, so with that, me just talking to myself, like saying, "Dude, you're gonna zero," it also just made me realize, like, you just use your common sense, just go, just move to your other area. But then also, while I was going to that area, just pay attention to everything. That's when I saw that water temp. Now, after the camera guy got on my boat, Dylan Nussbaum was also fishing in the area. Like, him and I end up, we share a lot of water for some reason in these tournaments. Dylan is a monster.
Like, oh, he's one of my favorites. Oh gosh, he's such a weapon.
Yes.
Yeah.
I love Dylan. He's one of the top anglers. He's very versatile in all these systems. So it kind of made me comfortable that he was there, because I'm like, well, that means there's fish around, So I could see he was using a different tactic than I was to catch these. But when the camera guy gets out of the boat, Dylan, the way he's approaching it, he's using his big motor to go into the waves, and then he's getting on his trolling motor and searching back with the waves. Once I put my trolling motor down, when I found that water temperature increase, I never touched my big motor until we were going back to the dock. So I would go with the waves, and then I would turn and go very slowly. The Kraken would push me into those waves, but I was going slow, which wasn't bad, because I'm like looking down on the bottom on these rocks. I'm like, these fish are swimming pretty fast. So going slow wasn't a terrible thing. But what I noticed was, after like making these spirals, like I would make these ovals, I'd go down the water, I'd turn, go back up, and then I would start, the water temperature would start lowering as I'd go back into the wind, and then I'd go back down and start raising a little bit. So I'm going to take a picture of this, but if you look at my tracks, I started leaving my tracks on after last season. But if you look at my boat tracks, you can see like a spiral, a spring type drawing, where my boat, when I'm searching in that last spot, is slowly moving to the east. And that line of hot, warm and cold water was almost a literal wall. And that wall, in the front of that wall, in that warm water, is where those fish were just loaded. In Green Bay terms, loaded, meaning like that's where a big majority of them were. And I started thinking about it, and I'm like, well, it's this lake started icing out on the west shore 2 days ago already during day one. Like, those fish are following that warm water all the way from over half the lake already. So yeah, there's going to be a bunch of fish over here.
Yeah.
So I kept following that as that wind kept pushing it slowly. I kept following that, staying right in front of that wall. And like I said, it was quick. Then I had picked out my three big fish, and filled up the live well and went in. But it was crazy what we were learning. But we have to take our own advice, not just we have to take the advice of people who are now teaching people. Now people might hear me and they're like, there might be some people still like, yeah, right, he's just saying that or this and that. But no, like, our brains play tricks on us. We want to go back to our spots. Fish history could be 2 days ago. It doesn't have to be 2 years ago or 2 months ago, there's nothing wrong with fishing history, but we have forward facing sonar now. And if we fish that history and look at that history today, nothing's there. Move. Could you imagine if I didn't have forward-facing sonar and go back there on day three, the final day, where I caught that 43 pounds? I'd be sitting there for probably 6 hours.
Oh, yeah, you'd have died on that hill.
Yep, I would have. Yep. But here's the thing. how many of us still would have fished that, made multiple drifts over it? A bunch of us. There's a bunch of people. I almost did it.
Well, so, this would be my question. This would be my question for that. Like, bite windows can happen in places. Bite windows can be, yes, can be a significant factor, yep, in a tournament. A lot of times that is, for a lot of anglers that I talk to, myself included, like, that is a lot of times the justification to go fish a memory like that. Like, let's just take one more pass because we know that, like, it's big fish potential, it's big fish memories, and maybe my timing was off. Like, it's bite, were bite windows a thing at all? Like, is that ever a factor for you, like, in these situations where you might decide to go back through or something that affect, but also too, like, you know, the getting back to like how confidence in catching these fish in your presentation, your batting average, like, you know, you picked your three biggest fish. Like, it was that good of a bite that you made three casts or three good casts and caught three fish. Like, was it that kind of a pace of catching it, of catching them? And was bite windows a factor? I guess it's kind of a two-part question. They're kind of related.
Yeah. So no, it wasn't like three casts, three fish. Now, I did catch two fish back-to-back casts, which has never happened to me that whole entire week, but no, it wasn't like bang, bang, bang. It wasn't that quick. It was maybe three fish in 30 minutes. So I was still casting. So I would say my average in pre-fish was I caught probably one fish every 50 to 100 fish I casted at. That's
okay.
A lot.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Now we're,
yep,
talking.
And that, yep. So that was, it was a tough, tough bite. In the tournament, you're talking about bite windows. So I do believe in bite windows, but you know, the only time that you have to worry about bite windows is when you're looking at fish.
Yeah.
So yeah, I went through that. I made that pass through there. There was no fish, not one. Yeah. So there's not going to be a bite window because there's no fish to bite. So that's why I was like, I got to leave. Now, let's just say I went through there and I saw the amount of fish I saw on day one, and they were still big.
Yeah.
And I was casting. And I knew 100% they were walleyes and they wouldn't bite for 2 or 3 hours. I would have sat right there. I would not have moved.
Yeah.
Because the fish are there. And I'm just waiting then for that potential bite window, throwing the same bait, not mixing anything up really. And throwing the same two presentations probably to get them to finally bite. So I do believe in bite windows. I think there's some to do with some the pressure systems, things like that. But the only time you're going to have a bite window is if there's fish down there to bite.
Dude, that is such a, but here's the thing, man. I mean, and maybe nobody's willing to admit it. Maybe nobody relates to this. I'm sitting here with my hand in the air saying, like, dude, I've talked myself into fishing memories terrible. I've done terrible things in the past where I have died on those hill where there was nothing on side imaging. There was no bait. There was like, I've probably fished miles away from a target fish and, yep, and wasted an 8-hour day because I caught them there yesterday. And I just, there's been times in my life where I can do that, and graduating from that is such a freeing, such a liberating moment in an angler's life. You don't have to be a tournament angler. Like, this is just, we're just talking about catching fish, and mm-hmm, and that blatantly obvious point is just that's a big one, man. So I appreciate you being able to talk to both sides of that coin though, because that's There's a lot to take away from that.
If I hit that first area, made that pass through there, I didn't see a single fish, but the water temp was still 66, 67 degrees like it was on day one, I would have made another pass through there because the water was stable, and those fish weren't just like sitting there. You know, it wasn't like a piece of structure where they're just sitting there. It was like a highway. It was like a highway, and I think there was a current break in that deep water there. And I think if the conditions would have stayed the same, like as water temp goes, it was just a travel corridor. So there's like
big pods.
Yes, there's pods moving through all the time. When I say pods, too, a lot of times people think I'm talking like a tight school of fish. I'm not. A school of fish to me can be 25 fish in the size of a football field.
Yeah.
You know, swimming together, that spread apart though, you know? And so I would have made another couple passes if the conditions, the temperature, all of that, the natural conditions were the same. But putting all of it together, I'm like, no.
Gotta go.
Yep.
Yeah, dude. And the other thing that is blows my mind about the, you know, what you're able to, you know, what you're able to execute, you know, on that, on the stage, the bright lights are shining. There's a lot going on. You know, you had, I'm sure just a, like, I don't know what you did to cope on the blow day, but you know, like the rest of the world was just like burning to the ground. Hopefully you just, you know, took some sleeping medication and watched movies and left your phone upside down. That being said, though, you said something there that definitely hit home with me when you're talking about making the adjustment. Okay, so you go through your primary area, you have this internal conversation that leads you to, you got to make an adjustment. You decide on that adjustment, and you have a spot in mind. Like you're heading, like you're describing this story that makes so much sense to me, that when I'm deciding to leave a spot, I'm kind of thinking about my next spot, like, you know, almost in terms of waypoints. Like I'm thinking, do I know another good area to go check? And I'll have those internal conversations. Or if I don't, I'm looking at the map thinking, where else can I go check? You know, and I'm trying to put all these pieces together, right? Just like anybody would. But when I decide on a spot, when I decide what I'm going to go check next, like I'm going to make an adjustment, what's that adjustment in terms of spot or area? I just drive there. Like I just drive there. Mm-hmm. Usually the only thing on my dash is my map. Mm-hmm. Like I drive to that area, and then I, you know, because I've made the decision that I got to switch areas. So then I just go, the fact that you had an area in mind, you had this, you know, this high risk, high reward area in mind, and you were heading there, but you never stopped being super hyper aware of, you know, your electronics, the temperature gauge, and you just, like, even with that other area in mind already, you took your boat off plane and started fishing because you saw water temperature. Like, you saw the potential for a condition. I mean, and we're not just talking a day of pre-fishing. We're not talking about a day of recreational fishing. This is the NWT Championship final day. Like it's the final, final. Mm-hmm. And you have zero fish in the box. You have a spot in mind, and halfway there, you're willing to take your boat off plane because you see a water temperature change. I don't want to like understate the fact that you knew that was a big deal, but still, as an angler, when I have my next spot in mind, I'm not looking at the electronics. I'm looking at my map and how fast can I get to that? You know what I mean? Like, dude, yeah. I just want to live in that moment for a little bit here and maybe have you kind of describe that. Maybe it's, you know, maybe there's more stories like that. Maybe like where and when did you learn that? Who taught you that? Like, how do you make it look easy to just be super aware of your surroundings all the time and then make it pay off in humongous moments like this? And I can't even do that or make it pay off when I'm just totally out by myself, like trying to impress my dog. Like I can't do it, man. Tom, teach me.
Well, like everybody always says, that tournament fishing is a huge mental game. Like, and you know, the buddies I travel with, buddy I fish with in Sakakawea, you know, I hear it a lot where they say, they describe me as patient. I hear that a lot. Like he's super patient to the point that it's almost annoying. Right. So like, but that part of me my patience is because I think of details. Because I'm so focused on the minor details, I want to break down a spot or figure out why these fish want this, don't want this. So it takes me a while to break down an area, break down a spot, and people call that patience. So when I'm going across that water that morning, the water temp I just left was like 57, 58 degrees, way colder than practice. That was 12, 13 degrees colder than the last day of practice. Okay. So, I'm going across and, so I'm going to that spot. I'm going to that high risk spot, my third spot. But the reason I'm going there too, it's the direction of the wind. But then also on my mind already is that water temp. Like I'm thinking like, okay, I'm already nervous about getting to that third spot. Like I'm nervous because I'm thinking, uh-oh, is that iced out too? Even though it's in the direction the wind's blowing, that might be iced out too. So that's why I was aware as I was driving on plane, not very fast in those waves, but I'm still going. But that's why I was aware to my water temp because I was watching that tick up. I was like, come on, please, just come on up, come up. Then all of a sudden, like I said, within just a short distance, it just rocketed up 4 or 5 degrees. And I'm like, oh, okay. So then I'm like, let's just stop here because, again, I'm going with the waves. That's the direction the warm water's pushing. That should be the direction the fish are going. Let's just see. Let's just look. That was my head. I wasn't thinking like, hey, let's stop here and catch fish. I was just thinking, let's just look. And instantly, when that kraken hit the water, I could see life. And that was hope for me, just life, period. And then so that's when my if you want to call it my patience took over and just started scanning around, looking around, like, let's see what's here. Let's see what's here. And like it was the most amount of life I probably saw all week due to that wall of warm water and those fish just staying ahead of it.
Yeah, it was like they were being pushed by a big long fence, like a bunch of cattle and everything else too, I'm sure. Yeah, like you say, like everything was there.
Well, I think I talked to you first, I think, back a couple years ago, a few years ago, when I described on Lake of the Woods, I described a school of saugers as my piece of structure. This water, this wall, this invisible wall of temperature change water was basically my structure at the end of the day. Like I was just staying on it. So anytime I went into the wind and start seeing my temperature drop just a few decimals, I would turn and work with the wind. I would stay kind of just right up there and work. And I was working crosswind most of the time. Dylan was probably wondering why is he doing that. So I was working crosswind,
But
trying to
you were
stay up
working
and down
with
that.
the you were aligned with the structure that you were fishing, which was water temperature. It's phenomenal. Oh man, dude. Was there some intense moments like that last hook set on that 28 or that 8 pounder?
Dude, it felt so good. It felt so good. Yeah, just feeling that bite and then just setting the hook. Rod just loads up like you hooked into a log. And my co-angler, was struggling. He getting the hook out of his mouth. He's like that thing was buried in the roof of the mouth. I was
Heck
like,
yeah, dude.
so perfect.
Yeah, and I mean, I know, historically, the black, the Northland tungsten jigs, Northland's got a whole bunch of jigs. If I was just going to ask you for just your gear setup, I probably don't ask you that enough. Everybody maybe just wants a little bit of a reminder. What is your setup like to completion? Like, what are the meaningful pieces of gear in that situation to win the NWT championship?
In my hand almost all the time is, well, okay, all the time are the rods I use are all medium light. They're the Daiwa TDI line of rods that we just released a couple years ago. But for the most part, I use medium light almost exclusively. And in, this situation, I was using a 7'3", a little bit deeper water. You know, I like those for my longer, a little bit longer cast and that kind of wind. If I'm shallow weeds or something, I like my 6.3s where I'm sharpshooting into these holes in the weeds for these walleyes. But and I have that rigged on with 10-pound chartreuse Daiwa braid and 8-pound test fluorocarbon. And it's important that my fluorocarbon leader is basically about the same length as my rod. You're right, like just the hook sets on that, like the give, the forgiveness of that tip helps me to confidently play a fish. I don't horse them in, as everybody knows. I get made fun of on TV shows all the time. They're like, Chase Parsons says, Tom, this is a 24-minute show and it takes you 22 minutes to reel in a 6-pounder, you know? And so, when I set that hook, it just feels perfect. It feels nice. That rod's doing most of the work in that deeper water on that light line. And, you know, I did have it paired with a 3/8 ounce tungsten. And, in that wind, though, I did tie on a 1/2 ounce smeltonator head in camo color. It's like a dark greenish brownish color, and that was actually key to getting my bait presented on that third day, where it would had a little bit of a faster fall, but I needed that when those winds were gusting like that because I had a big bowl on my line, and just to get that bait down where I needed it, and those hook sets felt so nice.
Yeah, dude. Yeah, dude. All right. 3 minute closer. And if I had a question written down, looking back on this season, like tough bites, tough fish to catch, like what was the toughest tournament limit that you caught? And what is like a tough bite to you? Like what is like a 1, 2, 3 list of recommendations for somebody like me or just amateur anglers to try and do to tackle like tough biting fish that are there but don't want to eat, like tough bite conditions. Anyways, go ahead.
So Green Bay was a tough bite, like meaning like I could see the fish, getting them to bite, whole different story. I think what sets me apart from most is the fact that even though I have live scope and I'm really good with boat control, I can watch my fish, watch my bait. I do not want to actually see the fish that I'm casting at physically eat my bait. I don't want to see that. I think most other people out there, we're human. We want to see that fish put that bait in its mouth. We want to see it commit. I never do. Never. So in a tough bite, I think that's where my advantage is because just by using this and studying these fish, this is a lot of information. So this could come back to bite me later, but you need to put it in this podcast because I force those fish to touch the bottom of the lake with their lips to pick up my bait. Every time, unless I'm using a reactionary style bait, that's a different story. But when I'm using finesse, plastics, live bait, I force them to pick it up off the bottom. I think in a tough bite, I think that is really key. In a good bite, they're gonna eat it. So it doesn't matter.
Yeah,
So
everybody can catch them in a good bite.
yep.
But yeah.
So I think that is key for anybody listening to this. Tournaments or not tournaments, you know, go out there and catch more fish. You're gonna see that. And what I teach in the university, people are picking up on it now because all my screen recordings that I have in my university, you never see my jig being hovered above a fish. See,
Yeah.
so that's what my advice there. You said 1, 2, 3 things. That's one thing that I think that people need to
That's all we need.
start doing more. Yep. And so now that's on a tough bite. Lacrosse this year, it was just a tough tournament. I didn't catch a limit either day, but that's a whole different story.
Yeah,
Like
I had those conversations.
that was a good bite. That was a good bite there, because
That
look
was
at
a
the
boat
guys kept
race.
throwing by. Yep.
For 75% of the field, it was a boat race. I don't want to say the wrong thing or whatever, but that's exactly why I wrote down that note specifically. I wanted you to talk about a place where you can, how do you catch five big fish? Even if nobody else is around, it's a non-tournament day. Yes, you answered it perfectly. That makes that it's exactly what I was looking for, because some places it doesn't tell the whole story when after day one, somebody with a bottom of the pack boat draw only caught two fish or zero fish. There's a lot more to that story than a tough bite. 100%. I appreciate you, Tom, a billion. And I thank you for every part of this, dude. This is another one. I'm never going to stop thinking about this. The fact that you had a spot in mind, but you saw the water temp and you pulled down off plane, I've never done that. I've never, ever, ever even dreamt of that. But I think that's true with all kinds of things, like wind direction, how, if it's wind driven, or water clarity was a big one for me. That's it, man. I'll let you back to it, Tom. Really appreciate the story. Congratulations, dude. Gosh, it's so fun to be a fan of yours. And you're the man, dude. So I hope to see you again, man. Soon. And, dude, enjoy it.
Okay, appreciate it.
All right, we'll talk to you.